Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
The United States Navy says it has banned its workforce in Japan from drinking alcohol and limited most of their activities to Navy bases. The announcement came after a U.S. sailor on the Japanese island of Okinawa was arrested on suspicion of drunk driving. Okinawa residents have demanded the removal of U.S. bases after several incidents involving armed forces members in recent months. The latest incident happened Sunday night. Japanese police arrested Petty Officer 2nd Class Amy Mahia after she reportedly drove on the wrong side of a road. She crashed her car into two vehicles, injuring two people, a police spokesman said. Mahia was not hurt, the Associated Press reported. Following the incident, U.S. sailors throughout Japan have been banned from drinking alcohol indefinitely, the Navy said in a statement. These incidents are not taken lightly, said Rear Admiral Matthew Carter. For decades, we have enjoyed a strong relationship with the people of Japan. The U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Caroline Kennedy, offered her regrets to the family of those injured in the accident. The U.S. Navy had already ordered all sailors to return to their bases by midnight local time. The Navy also banned all off-base drinking after a former U.S. Marine who worked on an American military base in Japan was arrested last month. That Marine was suspected of involvement in the disappearance of a Japanese woman. Police believe that she was raped and murdered. In March, a U.S. sailor was arrested on charges of raping a Japanese woman in Okinawa. Three U.S. servicemen were found guilty in the rape of a schoolgirl in 1995. That case angered many Japanese.
Many Americans are criticizing a 6-month jail sentence given to a former Stanford University student for raping an unconscious woman. Aaron Persky is a judge with the Superior Court of Santa Clara County in California. He sentenced 20-year-old Brock Turner to 6 months in a county jail and 3 years of probation under the court's supervision. Turner will also have to complete a sex offender management program and register as a convicted sex offender for the rest of his life. Government lawyers had asked for a 6-year state prison sentence. The woman Turner raped read an emotional statement in court before the sentencing. She described the painful details of being examined by medical workers after the attack. The woman also described how the sexual assault hurt her emotionally. "My independence, natural joy, gentleness, and steady lifestyle I had been enjoying became distorted beyond recognition," she said. Along with other emotions, she said, she became closed off, angry, tired, and empty. Her statement has gone viral and is being shared all over the internet. News media are not identifying the victim, which is their policy in sexual assault cases. Turner was a swimmer at Stanford, one of the nation's top universities. Brock Turner's father, Dan A. Turner, also wrote to the court before the sentencing last week. The Washington Post reports that Dan Turner wrote a letter saying his son should receive probation, not jail time. That is a steep price to pay for 20 minutes of action out of his 20-plus years of life, the father wrote. He will never be his happy-go-lucky self with that easygoing personality and welcoming smile, he added. District Attorney Jeff Rosen criticized the letter for calling the sexual assault 20 minutes of action. He also criticized Turner for not accepting responsibility for the crime. To this day, the defendant denies what he did, Rosen told the Washington Post. He added that Brock Turner preyed upon the woman and displayed violence. After the sentencing last Thursday, Rosen released a statement, according to the Associated Press. The punishment does not fit the crime, he said. The sentence does not factor in the true seriousness of this sexual assault or the victim's ongoing trauma. Campus rape is no different than off-campus rape. Rape is rape. Last March, Turner was found guilty of 3 felony sexual assault counts for the attack. It happened in January 2015. 2 graduate students found Turner assaulting the unconscious woman. She was behind a trash container with only some of her clothes on. Turner tried to flee, but the students grabbed him and held him down until police arrived and arrested him. Both the victim and Turner had blood alcohol levels above the legal limits, according to the San Jose Mercury News. The victim remembered drinking alcohol, but not the attack. She writes that she remembered waking up at a hospital in San Jose. A police deputy told her she may have been a victim of a sexual assault. In an editorial, the San Jose Mercury News called the 6-month county jail sentence a slap on the wrist. I'm Ann Ball.
Democratic Party presidential candidates are working to gain the support of Hispanic voters before the primary election in California on Tuesday. About 1/3 of adults in California are Hispanic. The campaigns of presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have been competing for their support. Volunteers have been working to convince Hispanics to register to vote. They also have been calling registered Democrats on the phone. The volunteers say they do not agree with many statements made by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. He has said Mexico is sending criminals into the United States. Trump says he is only criticizing those who do not obey the law. He notes some Hispanics support him. Maria Aguila, who lives near San Francisco, is one of his supporters. She says she does so because we need change. We need real change this time. Maria Alvarado Marquez is a Democrat. She supports and is a volunteer worker for Hillary Clinton. She lives near Los Angeles. She says she is insulted by Trump's statements. She says Muslims and people coming from Latin America to the U.S. are looking for a better life. These are all people who want freedom, religious freedom, economic freedoms, she said. She says both groups have been insulted by Trump. She says, this is probably the most important election of my life. Public opinion studies show that most Hispanics are worried about Trump's promise to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Stephanie Sandoval is a teacher. She says learning about her students' families has changed some of her political beliefs.
I've been kind of moderate, sometimes conservative in some issues, but seeing how, you know, those issues affect some people, for example, with Donald Trump and the wall, building the wall.
Her concerns caused her to hold a campaign sign in public. It is the first time she has become politically active. Hillary Clinton has more support among Hispanics than Bernie Sanders. But younger Hispanics support Sanders in much greater numbers than they support Clinton. Public opinion studies show Hispanics are most worried about economic issues and education. Political messages from both candidates talk about those issues. But Republican Donald Trump appears to be the strongest motivator for Hispanics to vote in Tuesday's Democratic primary. Raphael Sonnenschein is with the Pat Brown Institute at California State University, Los Angeles. He says if many Hispanics vote in the South and Southwest, they could have an effect on the election. He said, it could matter not in California, which is just going to go Democratic no matter what, but in Arizona and in Florida, which is one of the most competitive states in the country, which not only has Cuban Americans, but a large number of people who have moved from Puerto Rico in this last year. He says large numbers of Hispanic voters could affect state and congressional races in places like Arizona, which is almost one-third Hispanic. I'm Mario Ritter.
Islamic extremists in Iraq are shooting and killing civilians as they attempt to flee the city of Fallujah, a rights group says. The Norwegian Refugee Council said the civilians are hoping to escape from fighting between Islamic State militants and Iraqi government forces. The council said its information came from families that were in contact with the NRC. Our biggest fears are now tragically confirmed, with civilians being directly targeted while trying to flee to safety, said the group's director in Iraq, Nasser Muflahi. This is the worst that we feared would happen to innocent men, women, and children who have had to leave everything behind in order to save their lives. Fallujah has been under Islamic State control since 2014. Iraqi forces have been battling against the militants for several weeks in an effort to retake the city. The latest offensive has led to Iraqi forces surrounding the city on three sides. The only area not yet captured is along the western bank of the Euphrates River. The Norwegian Refugee Council estimates about 3,000 families escaped Fallujah during the early days of the military offensive, which began on May 21st. But since then, the group said, only a few families have been able to flee. United Nations officials estimate that about 50,000 civilians are trapped in Fallujah. Some people have tried to cross the 300-meter-wide Euphrates in an effort to escape. But the UN said several people, including children, drowned while crossing the river. I'm Brian Lynn.
U.S. and Chinese officials Monday called for more diplomacy to ease tension over China's claims to the South China Sea. But experts say the dispute will continue. Key leaders from both countries met in Beijing Monday for the 8th Strategic and Economic Dialogue. It is a yearly meeting designed to build cooperation between Chinese and U.S. leaders. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry opened Monday's meeting. He said the United States has not taken a position on China's claims over the South China Sea. The only position we've taken is let's not resolve this by unilateral action. Let's resolve this through rule of law, through diplomacy, Kerry said. China has accused the United States of taking sides against China's South China Sea's claims. Chinese President Xi Jinping said Monday that China and the U.S. need to increase communication and cooperation over Asia-Pacific affairs. China already has said it will not accept a ruling from a United Nations panel over its claims to almost all of the South China Sea. The sea covers about 3.5 million square kilometers from Singapore and Malacca Straits to the Strait of Taiwan. It is one of the world's most important waterways. In recent years, Chinese crews have developed artificial islands complete with airstrips. There are competing claims to the sea by Vietnam, the Philippines, Brunei, Malaysia, and Taiwan. In recent months, there has been conflict between the U.S. and China over the South China Sea. One of the most tense occurred last month when Chinese warplanes came close to a U.S. Navy patrol plane flying over the South China Sea. During a visit last month to Vietnam, President Barack Obama drew cheers when he said, "Big nations should not bully smaller ones." The China Daily, which shares the views of the Chinese government, said Obama and Vietnam risk turning the region into a tinderbox of conflicts. Bonnie Glazier is director of the China Power Project for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She said the UN ruling, expected soon, will probably not slow China's activities along the South China Sea. But she said it is possible China will accept parts of the UN panel's ruling, even as it officially rejects it. That might include stopping its interference with fishing along the South China Sea, Glazier said. The South China Sea wasn't the only issue brought up during Monday's U.S.-China meeting in Beijing. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew asked China to cut steel production. Lew said too much Chinese steel is flooding markets and hurting producers, including from the United States. President Xi promised steps to reduce Chinese steel production, but announced no new steps. I'm Bruce Alpert.
Muslims began observing the holy month of Ramadan Monday with the first sighting of the new moon. For most Muslims, Ramadan is taking place this year from June 6th to July 5th. During this period, Muslims are supposed to eat just two meals a day. One is called suhoor, which is the meal before sunrise. The other meal is iftar. That is the meal at sunset. For countries in the northern half of the world, the longest day of the year falls during Ramadan. As a result, some Muslims will be avoiding meals for up to 17 hours a day during the month. What is the main advice for the millions of people who have begun this fasting period? Use reason and common sense when eating meals at night. Razin Mwaruf is a medical specialist from the British city of Oxford. He warns against eating too much during the non-fasting hours. He told the NHS Choices website that the underlying message behind Ramadan is self-discipline and self-control. He said the early morning meal should include foods that are filling yet provide energy for many hours. He suggests eating slow-digesting foods such as pita bread, salad, cereal, and toast. Health experts and health websites urge those who are fasting to avoid foods high in fat and sugar, as well as fried foods, especially during the nighttime meal. Lovely Raghunath works as senior nutritionist at the Dubai World Trade Center. She told Gulf News that sleeping and drinking plenty of fluids at night are also key to staying healthy during Ramadan. Waking up for suhoor becomes difficult as the digestion of fried foods interferes with our sleep cycle, Raghunath told Gulf News. She said a lack of fluids can cause not only dehydration, but stomach problems as well. There are more than 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country. More than 196 million Indonesians are Muslim. More than 3.3 million Muslims live in the United States. Many Muslims end their fast by eating a date and having a drink of water. The Prophet Muhammad started that tradition nearly 1,400 years ago.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. On a cold December day in 2014, the body of a newborn baby girl was recovered in Indianapolis, Indiana. The body was found off a snowy path in a public park. A medical examiner later ruled that the girl was born healthy. She died, Fox News reported, from being left in the cold and from animal bites to her arms and legs. The girl now has a name, Amelia Grace Hope. Linda Zeneko named the baby. She is with Safe Haven, a religious organization that buries abandoned children. Zeneko believes Amelia Grace did not have to die. She says that the mother could have felt she had no other choice.
It was really just 2 miles away from a fire station. And, you know, if that mother, maybe an under-resourced, desperate mom who was terribly afraid, would have been able to just find her way 2 miles down the road, she may have been able to surrender that baby, and the baby could be alive today.
That is because there was a safe place not far from where Amelia Grace was found. Since 2008, legal guardians throughout the United States may surrender babies 45 days or younger to any emergency medical service provider. They can do this without fear of being charged with a crime. Yet, across the country, about 150 babies each year are left in waterways, along roadsides, and in waste cans. Many, many years ago, a woman named Monica Kelsey was abandoned as a baby. Now Kelsey works as a firefighter. She said she felt she had to do something. She found the answer while visiting a church in South Africa, which had a baby safe.
It was for mothers who didn't want to be identified.
Keeping the mother's name private has led to safe child surrenders in many countries, including South Korea, China, and Canada. It did not take long for Kelsey to launch Safe Haven baby boxes in the U.S. The baby boxes are made of metal, but have soft padding on the inside. Each has a climate-controlled thermostat. This device changes the temperature inside the box based on the weather conditions outside. When a baby is placed in the box, it activates an infrared light and series of silent alarms. These alarms notify emergency personnel within a minute. Monica Kelsey met Linda Zinecco because of the case of baby Amelia. Together, the women worked to try to persuade Indiana's state legislature to change the Safe Haven law. They wanted to protect people who use the boxes and those dropping off babies in person. The Indiana Department of Health opposed the plan. In a report to the legislature, it warned against using a system with no policies to protect the newborn left inside the box. Zinecco disputed the department's warning. She explained what really happens when an abandoned baby dies.
I offered them the reality that I've seen the autopsy results that are written about the condition of these babies when they are found. And it's so tragic, it's so hard to read, that even if a baby were to die in the baby box, it would be an attempted rescue on their life.
Safe Haven baby boxes made its program stronger by adding an automatic lock to the outside of the boxes. This ensures that only emergency personnel could remove the newborns from the interior door. The legislature unanimously amended the law. Monica Kelsey's husband, Joe, is the mayor of Woodburn, Indiana. He approved a plan for setting up the first baby box at the local fire station.
I'm very proud that Woodburn is the first city to have Safe Haven baby boxes, and if one life is saved during the whole term that I'm mayor, it'll be the best thing.
Each box costs about $2,000. A civic organization, the Knights of Columbus, paid for the first 100 boxes. Kelsey gets emails every day from people asking for a box in their hometown. The next three locations have already been chosen. They are in high abandonment areas in Indiana.
Our goal is 10% of these babies that are being abandoned. That's where we're going to start. I think through the years, though, that number is going to grow and eventually, hopefully, save 100% of the babies that are being illegally abandoned.
The baby boxes came too late to save Amelia Grace Hope. But she left her mark in her own small way. Her footprint is used in signs for the program. I'm Ana Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.